Mark Houston. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm very grateful and honored to be here. Joe and I'll probably talk a little bit more about this later, but this is the last one of these that we're going to be doing probably for a long time. Both of us, in our own way, have been driven to, a state of silence. So, coincidentally, this is the 12th one of these we've done together. So, we feel, very honored and blessed to be here. And actually, we're both excited about some. Typically, when we do these in our own way, we kind of put some restrictions on ourselves, and we're just going to download all of it to you. This son of a bitch is going to be wide open. You're going to get the best that we have to download. So I'm excited about that. I want to read a few lines out of working with others. About the only thing Joe and I have ever done when we get asked to do these is meditate before we come. That's the only preparation. Because all we're here to share with you is our experience, so I don't have to spend much time making notes about that, do I? But in that meditation, I was directed to a few sentences in working with others, which to me describe what I think will happen here. So I just want to go over some of them with you. Life will take on new meaning, to watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience that you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers with each other is the bright spot of our lives. Because of our own drinking experience, we can be uniquely useful to other alcoholics. Probably going to talk about alcohol this weekend. To be helpful is our only aim. If you don't want to stop drinking, we're not going to waste time trying to persuade you. But we are going to ask you if you want to quit for good and if you go any extreme to do so. If you say yes to that, we will draw your attention to the fact that we are recovered as a result of this process. If we're satisfied you're a real alcoholic, we're going to begin to dwell on the hopeless feature of this malady. We're going to continue to talk about alcoholism as an illness, a fatal malady this weekend. And we're going to keep talking to you about the hopelessness of alcoholism because this book offers a solution. To be vital, faith must be accompanied by self-sacrifice, unselfish, constructive action. We hope to disturb you about the question of alcoholism. This will be to your good. The more hopeless you feel, the better, because then you're more likely to follow the suggestions in this book. We're here to lay out the kit of spiritual tools for your inspection, and we're going to show you how they have worked with us. We're going to ask you to read this book, and after doing that, you must decide for yourself whether or not you want to go on. If you're to find God, the desire must come from within. And that's all this program is about. There's a desire to find God because lack of power becomes my dilemma. Typically when Joe and I do these, we take a little bit of time just to kind of clear off the things I think that stand between us and probably what's supposed to happen here. Mostly what I want to tell you a little bit about is where I am currently in this process of seeking God and in the steps. And I started the steps again on July 28th up in Breckenridge, Colorado. I was up at a convention. Every year I become willing to submit and surrender to the steps again because they take me to levels of consciousness I've had no experience with ever before. And so I started step one up there. I made a decision the next person that asked me to go through this process with them that I would not go through that. I wouldn't take them through it. We'd go through it together. So we did that, and I've had an interesting experience this time of God being really in total charge of my experience with each step. And I got to experience step one for about a month, damn near moved to Montana. I've been through this enough, though. I have done things like that before when I went through this work, and I didn't know what the hell was going on with me, and I ran. One time I left Denver and moved to Seattle, Washington. That cost me about $40,000, somewhere in there. So if you're going through and having experience with step one, I might suggest that you sit with it, but this time I knew what was going on. That lasted about a month. And the second step, once again, I had an incredible experience with the second step. That also was about a month. The third step was about the same experience for me. And again, what has happened to me this time, unlike any other time, this is not a question of... sometimes in the past, what I will do when I will go back through the steps is I'll pick a date to start a date to be done with amends, those kinds of things. But this time, in going through the steps, God is determining what happens to me in this whole experience. And it might have happened before. I just don't have any memory of it in my past experience. And I think that I've just recently completed column one in my four steps. So that's where I am currently with going back through the steps again. Because I believe what the big book says, that my hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience. Growth of a spiritual experience. Not living off the food I ate last year, let alone yesterday. Because I also believe what the big book says when it says I'm given a daily reprieve on fit spiritual condition. Now, I'm a runner. I run every day. If I ran 2 days a week, I don't think I'd be in very fit spiritual physical condition. My experience is the same as true in the spiritual life. If I want to maintain some fit spiritual condition, there's a series of actions I need to be taking every single day. So that's currently where I am with the steps. And when I go back through the steps, I do that from a position of the 10th and 11th step. Because I've entered the world of the Spirit, and I will never leave the world of the Spirit. I operate in the world in steps 10 and 11. And I use 10 and 11 to go back through the process of the steps again. It's my method of seeking. So that's currently where I am in this process. Somewhere around probably about 6 or 8 months ago, I began to meet a lot of resistance within myself when I was either asked to speak, whether it's 50 minutes. Joe and I had done, I think, one or two of these together, and I had some resistance within myself. Some of you I met in June. There was resistance within me. I recently, the last one I did a retreat in Brenham, Texas with 32 people, and there was a lot of resistance within me. But the definition of honest for me is say what you do and do what you say, and I've made commitments, so I showed up. And basically what had to happen is my spirit had to be involved with those. And at the end of them, I was absolutely physically, for example, in New York, after Joe and I did the experience in New York, it took me well over a week to even begin to get centered up again. I had to do a lot of prayer, and I had to do a lot of meditation, and I had to do a lot of work. And one of the things the 10th step is about for me today is about being awake and listening. And God, what are you trying to tell me? And the thing that became very evident to me is at least for quite some period of time, I'm to be still and know that He is God. And when you're running around speaking and doing these kinds of things, you cannot do that. And I have my own opinion on that. I believe that in Alcoholics Anonymous, this is my opinion, people should only be allowed to speak for a short window of time and then not allowed to speak anymore. Because I certainly have experience with you cannot defeat the ego and you will attach to it. And if that can't go on within Alcoholics Anonymous, if we can't police that, then I believe it's our own responsibility to do that. And there was a lot of stuff that lined up for 97, and I basically have canceled all that. It was most interesting watching how the world wants to pull you back in again. Oh, we've got to, you know, Joe and I, we're asked to speak down in Corpus Christi, Texas. A lot of our AA family will be there, and the world will try and pull you back time and time again when you begin to seek God. But I just finally told people, you know, I'm here to conform to the will of God, and when He makes Himself that apparent to me, I will listen to it. And the truth is, the day I made the decision to stop speaking and doing retreats and workshops, my spirit became so animated, it was absolutely incredible. And I am so excited about what the next, I know at least minimum all through 97, have to offer for me, because I know it's about a much deeper experience with this power. So, I'm also excited about doing this, because in my own way, my spirit knows that for quite some time I don't have to do this again. And, so that's currently where I'm at in this incredible process called Seeking God. And my method of that is in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, all three parts of this program. I mentioned briefly my home group. I belong to the Carry the Message group in Kerrville, Texas. It's a group that about four of us about 4 years ago started. You know, the big book says, Mark, if you don't have the fellowship you crave, go create it. So we did, and we now have four meetings a week. And, you know, Kerrville's a very small town, 18,000 people. And Wednesday night there were 56 people at our closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And members of that group show up with Big Book. And our format is that they're closed meetings. Two of them are. One's a beginner. One of them is carry a meeting to a treatment center. And the format is that if I'm the chairperson for the month and I ask you to bring a discussion, I'll ask you a week ahead of time. I'll ask you to take it into prayer and meditation. What would God have you bring to our meeting? for his children who are going to be at the meeting. And then we have a bell, and so the longest anyone speaks is 5 minutes. Go over 5 minutes, we ring the bell on you. We're not interested in your past experience with the topic. We're interested with your current experience. So the group keeps growing and growing and growing, and the people, the men and women in that group stay sober, and it's absolutely wonderful. There was a meeting on the 10th step on Wednesday, and I heard things I never heard before. It just blew my mind from various links of sobriety, and I feel very proud to be a member of that group. You know, I'm a drunk sitting in that group, and it's an absolutely wonderful thing for me to experience. So don't ever sit and tell me you're in Virginia Beach, Virginia, and, you know, if you come up to me and say, oh, you know, no meetings here, I like me, blah, 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 blah. Well, I can tell you from my own experience that this book means exactly what it says. If you can't find meetings to feed your spirit, then create the fellowship that you crave. The book says you've recovered and been given the power to help others. This is about God. You know, you can create the fellowship you crave. That becomes important to me. I need to feed my spirit. You know, one of the great things, Joe and I don't get to see each other that much, but when I get around Joe, my spirit gets real animated. When I get around men and women who are seeking God through a series of actions, not lip flap and bullshit, my spirit gets real animated. So those are the people I hang with. I learned the hard way your environment has more power than what you can bring to bear on it. I don't go to middle-of-the-road solution meetings for any length of time. Because trust me, they will have an impact on you whether you believe that or not. Your environment has power over you. So that's a little bit about where I'm at right now, currently in my life. For those of you who know me for a while, I'm still single. I have been for a year. That's amazing. I thought I'd say that before Joe did. but I...
He gets married a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully in inventory I'll show you how you break free of attachments. Hopefully the husband's died away. Of course, the son of a bitch could be over doing push-ups too, waiting to come back into existence again. But we do inventory. We're going to do some stuff which probably won't go on tape called Theater of the Lie that we like to have a lot of fun with. That may show some of you some things about inventory that maybe you haven't seen before. But, you know, and all the time I've been around the program, my sense is, at least when I look at this year, that I've been more at peace with Mark inside on a daily basis, hourly basis. And it seems to have manifested itself in my life in many, many, many ways. More comfortable with being Mark than I've ever been. And that for me is a wonderful thing. So anyhow, that's where I'm at. And again, I'm so grateful to be here. You know, this program is about a way of living. I shared this last night. You know, I got up at 4:30 in the morning, which I do Monday through Friday. I get my feet on the floor. I don't talk about seeking God. I get my damn feet on the floor. And I spend some time in prayer and meditation, and then I run, and run has become prayer for me. It's not running, it's prayer. And when I got done with that, I drove to San Antonio, and I hopped a plane, and I landed in Atlanta, and then I landed here. And then I'm sitting up in a hotel room, and the ocean's beckoning to me and meditating. And then I went to a meeting, and seeing Joe again and seeing Melba. Melba flew in from McAllen, Texas, and seeing a bunch of you that I'd seen before. You know, I tell you something, on my own power, drunk or sober, I don't have any power to do any of that. Hell, 3 months ago, I'd heard of Virginia Beach, Virginia, because I sponsored a couple of guys in the Navy, and it came up in their inventory. I had no plans on being here. You know, my life is so exciting when I'm aligned with the will of God, because I don't have a clue what the hell is going to happen tomorrow, let alone tonight. And that's a wonderful thing. The more out of control the whole thing is, the more mystical and exciting that it is to me. So I'm excited to be here. I'm excited about spending some time with Joe. Excited about seeing some of you again that I've come to know. Joe and I are having a similar experience. It seems like the longer I seek God, my capacity to love you all gets taken to a level that consistently just amazes me. And more often than not, when I spend time with people, it becomes in its own way something that becomes holy and sacred. And so anyhow, I'm so grateful to be here. I'm grateful to spend this weekend with you. I again will encourage you in a couple areas. Some stuff is going to come up, and some of you are going to get pissed off and angry, and you're going to think it's about us, and your ego is going to do many, many things with you this weekend. And I ask all of you that when that happens, don't run from any of it. You know, Joe and I don't have any power to make anybody mad. All that happens is that some things will get mentioned that will bring up things that are within you that you need to look at. And I'll encourage you to sit with that and to not run from that. we discovered if we talk a little bit on the front end about what's going to happen with some of you, that you'll have a tendency to be able to sit and go through the experience. And the last thing I'll share before I turn over to Joe is, I also would strongly suggest those of you who are here this weekend to spend some time in reflection after you leave here and not share this experience. There's something about when God gives us a task to do, like in the next year, I know three very specific tasks that God would have me do, and I will not share those with you. I will share them with you when I'm on the other side of the experience, because I've been in the middle of experiences and shared them and begin to have the power taken away. So I would ask all of you after this weekend to sit for a period of time until such point in time as your spirit says it's okay to share what's going to happen with you here this weekend. To sit with it. Whether it's comfortable or uncomfortable. I mean, the spiritual life, I read a quote the other day from Father Keating, which I loved. It said, the one thing that you can be absolutely sure of in the spiritual life is that what you think is going to happen will never happen. And that is my experience in the spiritual life. So maybe the truth is that if you get incredibly uncomfortable this weekend, maybe that's absolutely one of the best things that could ever happen to you. And maybe if you get real disturbed about alcoholism, maybe that's the best thing that could ever happen. And maybe if you came here real comfortable and get real uncomfortable, that's a real neat thing. And maybe if you came here real uncomfortable and got comfortable, maybe that's the way that's supposed to be too. So anyhow, I'm glad to be here. Glad to be sharing some time with you all. Thanks.
I'm Joe. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here. So there's no misunderstanding. Neither of us are leaving AA. Anybody here that's ever had a service commitment in the general service structure knows that just about the time you get good at it, they make you do something else. And both of us have come to an experience. I don't even know how to describe the experience. I'm in the middle of something that I don't have any control over, which leads me to wonder, when did I? Since a certain decision was made to give that. You know, how I'd like it to go and how I'd like it to be. And see, because I'd like to go on with the experience I'm currently in the middle of, where I'm just like sitting back and I'm watching these things happen and realizing that that's been going on for a long time. And realizing for how long I mouthed the words that I had given my will to God and I hadn't. And I was just mouthing the words and it was still my plan, my way, my will. And I'm in the middle of experience, 14 years sober, having been doing this work and seeking God for a long time, that I hope I can talk about this weekend. I don't know. But neither of us are leaving AA, and we'll probably continue talking out to alcoholics. And this kind of stuff is just something that neither of us need to be doing now for a while, at least 1 year. I think if more speakers did that, then they would give other people a chance to grow, and a lot of them don't. I met some speakers, some of my disillusionment. My place is in my living room, one-on-one with alcoholics and a home group. Now, I don't know where that home group's going to be after the beginning of the year. Matter of fact, I spoke to a lady the other day. I was in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous out in a suburb of Los Angeles in the middle of this experience that's going on where I'm being moved again. 10 years ago, I was moved from a very comfortable place in Denver with my sponsor down the street and working with people and a commitment on the area committee, H&I chairman for the state of Colorado, and working with others. And I was very comfortable with a good income and financially secure, and in the middle of a set of amends, finishing those amends, I was moved to Santa Monica for reasons that I didn't even begin to understand. I don't know if I still understand all the ramifications of why I was moved to Santa Monica, but I know it really helped me, and I wasn't awake to it as I am now, and I'm in the middle of an experience now where the other day I was in a meeting in Pacoima, which is a suburb of Los Angeles, and I opened the Grapevine. Of course, this month's Grapevine talks about AA around the world, because, see, AA is not a place. and AA is not something you go to, at least for me anymore. AA used to be really small, and it was this little group that I, until I stood in one of those stadiums, 3 years sober in 1985 in Montreal, with 50,000 alcoholics from all over the world, and AA blew open for me. That also happened for me the night that my sponsor shared with me the circle and triangle, and I saw a program with three parts, and I wasn't in it. I was not in AA, and I didn't know that until somebody shared all three legacies with me. And in this meeting the other night, I opened to a page in the back of the Great Wall. The first page I opened to was an article by a man from India, and I want to meet him. And the next page I turned to, just by chance, I was drawn to this letter, and it was from a girl. She said, "Hi, my name's Carrie, and I'm an alcoholic, and I got sober in Denver, Colorado in 1982, blah, 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 and I'm the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous in Kathmandu, Nepal, and we have three meetings a week, and there's 30 of us." And the next day I was on the phone with her. She works in the U.S. Embassy in Kathmandu, and I'm going to meet her. And I'm in the middle of an experience that I don't have any control over, which leads me to believe that the times I've thought that I have since making the third step decision, I really haven't. There's a few things I've been experiencing lately that I want to talk about and get off my mind and begin to see, because this, if anybody's here to study the big book, you're wasting your time. Studying the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is a waste of time, unless it gets you excited about doing what's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a story about that my grand sponsor told me once, about a guy calls his sponsor and he says, "I read the book and I drank." And every other week, "I read the book and I drank." And the sponsor says, well, he gets tired of hearing that. He says, "Go get a cookbook." The guy comes back on the phone. He says, "Now turn to the page that says how to make a chocolate cake." And he says, "Okay." He said, "Now read it." He said, "Okay." Now he said, "Now read it." He said, "Okay." He said, "Now read it." He said, "Okay. Now memorize it." And he gets it memorized. And he says, "Now did you read it?" "Yeah." "Did you memorize it?" "Yeah." He said, "Now cut me a piece." This is not a book to read. This is a set of instructions to have a spiritual awakening as the result of those instructions. That's what it's been for me. And it's been a miraculous experience every time I've submitted myself to it. If you can't tell already, Mark and I have not been taught by people who sell the program short and tell you that you work the first nine steps once and live the rest of your life in steps 10, 11, and 12, because none of our founders, nor anything I've ever read, if you have, I'd love for you to show me, did any of our founders or anybody in AA that has anything that I want ever sell the program short? I mean, even the 12th step says to practice these principles in all your affairs. And I'll tell you a little bit about our line of sponsorship. And I think if you're new, it's important to know your lineage, because you got to know in AA there's a lot of families and there's a lot of schools of thought. And the sad part about AA nowadays is, when they used to say, and it used to bother me, there's as many ways to work the program as there are people in it. The sad thing nowadays is, it's true. And to do what's in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous has now come to a place where it's something you have to choose. And it's something you have to choose based on your own truth. And I'd like to look at that truth in a minute, of why would you even need to do what's in this big book. Our line of sponsorship starts with, and we got sober in the same town in Denver, 1982, about 60 days apart. We both went to the same treatment center. I was well on my way into a recovered state by the time he came along 60 days later. I've been reminding him of that on a regular basis ever since.
And the only time I ever got in trouble is when he wasn't my spiritual advisor.
He ended up in the nut house 9 years sober because I hadn't worked with him that year. Just kidding. We had the same sponsor, and we lived in the same house for 2 years in Denver before I moved to California and he moved to Texas by way of several other places and a lot of money and a couple wives. And, I've never been married. He's been married several times and we're both exactly the same. we're not different. Our sponsor is a man named Don P. from Denver, Colorado, who got sober in the Colorado State Penitentiary 30 years ago. He's been doing the work since week one in it. He got sober in a group in the penitentiary where you had to go through the steps before you could go to their regular meeting, the New Life Recovery Group in Canyon City, Colorado State Penitentiary. He now works for the Department of Corrections. You can't get from his cell to working for the Department of Corrections on your own power. His last boss in North Carolina went from an inmate to a warden, Tom I. Mm-hmm. Now Don's back home in Denver. His sponsor is a man named Gary Brown from Indianapolis, Indiana, 35 years sober, been doing the work 35 years, very humble, very simple man. He has what I want. I'm not willing to go to Indianapolis to get it, but he has what I want. Just kidding. His sponsor, Gary's been doing it 35 years. Gary's sponsor is a man named Paul Martin in Chicago, Illinois, with 50 years, been doing this work 50 years. One of the most exciting men I've ever met in my life, let alone in Alcoholics Anonymous. Their group in Chicago, they do 1 through 9 at the drop of a hat. They keep current inventory just for people that come in from out of town. They do unbelievable stuff. Those are the ones that are alive. His sponsor was Paul Stanley, the first member of AA in Chicago, who was brought in by Dr. Bob, who was brought in by our founder, our other founder, Bill Wilson. And I'm proud to be a part of that family. And in the middle of that family, you don't see a lot of people drink. You see people drink that stop doing this work that's necessary to stay in a recovered state, to enjoy the fellowship and be of service. We get it all backwards nowadays. We think they're supposed to start enjoying life and feeling better and loving the fellowship before they do what's necessary to recover, to enjoy those things and be of service. Back when this book was right, in the percentage that stayed sober, you know where they stay in here? 50% got sober, another 25% soon after. That's a 75% recovery rate. They used to bring you to recovery before they brought you to your first meeting. You used to go through the first 8 steps before you were allowed. Some, like they describe in here, they'd go through the first 8 steps in a few hours before they even left Dr. Bob's office, before you came to the fellowship. They cared more about the fellowship then than we do now, a lot more. We just saw, bring them to a meeting. I'll tell you a story about that later, about my trip to Jamaica, where I learned about common welfare coming first in a town where there's only one group, from a town where there's 2,000. I was going to tell them about common welfare. I didn't know a thing about common welfare. I think it needs to be mentioned that there's a big difference between anybody who's here to get some more knowledge so you can go back to where you come from and sound better, or cram it down their throats because you can quote the big book, that kind of knowledge, and having some real experience right now, right here this weekend. Because we're not here to transmit knowledge or information. We're not here to share about how to mark your book just right or get it down or memorize it or be able to recite it. We're here in the hopes that some of you, if you're willing to use a prayer in your own words in your own way tonight, soon, in a few minutes, Mark's going to take us through this prayer. Tonight before you go to bed, tomorrow morning when you get up, tomorrow morning before we start, anytime you're awake to doing this prayer in your own words, in your own way, I think this prayer can open each of us up in our own way, and not only can there be an experience at the group level that you will begin to feel as we come close to the end of this first step, and you will feel it shift as we move into step two, you'll be able to have your own personal experience with the first step if you're willing to get past the knowledge you currently have. Because see, if each of us in our own way would like to have an open mind and a new experience, then our knowledge, everything up to yesterday, goes from our greatest asset to our greatest liability. Now, what do I mean by that? If I want to have a new experience with the steps, and you ask me what's my greatest asset up to today is my knowledge of my experience and my ability to share it. Now, if I want to have a new experience and get past where I am to a new dimension of peace and freedom and existence, then my knowledge now turns 180 degrees and it's my worst enemy. Matter of fact, it's the only thing between me and getting past where I am. So we're going to talk about that prayer, and we're going to talk a lot about the difference between knowledge and experience. If you're here for knowledge, just the questions that are going to be raised will create in you an experience that will drive you out of the room if God doesn't have more power than your ego. But that's the whole bet here, isn't it? A guy asked me at lunch today, does booze have as much power as God? And I said, boy, I've been betting for 14 years that it doesn't. I'm here because God has more power than booze. But that wasn't the way it was for 18 years. How does that shift? We have to get back. I have to get back. Every alcoholic and every Al-Anon in this room has to get back to their own first step to see once again why they need God. So comfort, 10 years ago in Denver, Colorado, when I was moved to Santa Monica, if I would have settled for comfort, I would have stayed where I was comfortable. And I was willing to move past my comfort zone. Mark was talking that term way before I understood what it was. Be willing to move past your comfort zone, the rut that you're currently stuck in, based on a belief system that leads you to do things you're not even awake to. Past the comfort zone to levels of peace and freedom. See, you know when you're new and they tell you the truth will set you free? They always leave out, but first it'll really piss you off. They always leave that out, right? So once again, in the middle of this experience that started for me a few weeks ago in Australia, see, last week I was home. Week before that, I was in Muscatine, Iowa. Week before that, I was in Sydney, Australia. So when I got to Muscatine, Iowa, I said, you can't get from Sydney, Australia to Muscatine, Iowa on your own power. And having some power now in my life, I had to wonder, why would you even want to, right? I'd like to be in Sydney, Australia tonight than Virginia Beach, Virginia. But because of a way that I've chosen to live, I had to be here, but I can't even get from Santa Monica to Virginia Beach. I can't even get from the hotel over there over to here on my own power on time when I said several months ago. I can't live like that. See, I believe if you got here and your problem was powerlessness over alcohol with an unmanageable life, and you say you've experienced the solution here, you should have power over alcohol and manageability in your life, or something's terribly wrong, right? Now, I need to know where that power over alcohol and the power to manage my life comes from. That's where I get in trouble. That's why I need to sit and return home and get centered and be still and pray. Because I forget where the power over alcohol and the power to manage my life comes from, and I start to take the credit. A couple more things. Care, I'd like to look at two words, care and hope. And I'd like to talk about a kind of care that's taken a lot of work to get to, realizing that I can't get myself from how I used to care to how I care today. I believe this. If you care about other alcoholics, maybe for the first time in your life, you care about somebody else there and you want to be effective in your life, in all that you do, and especially with alcoholics, there are certain things that you must care about, and there are certain things that if you care about, you will not be affected. Now, let me give you an example. Let's say there were just two of you in this room that I was trying to share with, and I cared about how you felt about what I might have to say. I will, within a few minutes, go absolutely crazy, because with just two of you in the room, let alone 80, with just two of you, within 15 minutes, you're going to feel, and if you're alcoholic and these questions start to be asked, you're going to feel every emotion there is. And in 10, 15 minutes, you're going to feel the opposite of everything you were feeling 15 minutes ago. And if I'm concerned with how you feel about what I have to say, I will be of absolutely no use, because I will be consumed with not how you feel. It'll be an ulterior motive, because I don't want to get uncomfortable. So under the guise that I care about how other alcoholics feel, I was fooling myself. That doesn't mean I don't care about you. I care about you in a way that transgresses, that transcends emotion. I care about whether alcoholics live or die. And I have been able to watch that in my life manifest itself with the power of God in my life. That's real care. You cannot care about what any alcoholic you ever share with does with what you share with them, or you will go absolutely crazy. I've worked with a lot of alcoholics, and some of them have done some really strange stuff. But how do I know? I believe God's working in my life. I don't believe God's working in their life. I trust my intuition, but I don't trust your intuition. They've done the same work I have. I must believe that God's working in their life. I cannot care about what they do with what I'm going to share with them, or I will go crazy. And I came to this one night when I was sitting at home, and I made the mistake of looking at a grapevine, which is usually a mistake. Sometimes it's right on, but I made the mistake of looking in the back of the grapevine, you know, where they list all the conferences in the next 2 months. And I started thinking about where I wasn't going to be speaking. And I realized that that was a great game my ego was playing with me, to not be centered and focused where I was going to speak that night. And by the time this went on for about, you know, anything goes on in my mind for more than 10 or 15 minutes, I take it from a hangnail to bone cancer, right? So within 10 or 15 minutes, I was then thinking about all the people in Los Angeles that were not asking me to work with them. Right? And all the places in Los Angeles that I wasn't being asked to speak, and all the people in Los Angeles that don't like me, and where I wasn't being asked to speak around the country and the world and all this, and I was just totally consumed within about 5 or 10 minutes. Because I started to care about something that you absolutely can't care about and be affected in the moment where you are. And one of those things is how any of you feel about what either of us might bring up this weekend, because we can't make you feel uncomfortable. I belong to a group that has a pretty interesting format, which I'll tell you about later this weekend. And we've gotten so compulsive, there's 3 different formats a month, but that's our problem. But in each of those formats, anybody can ask anybody anything they want. It's not so much crosstalk, back and forth. It's more like questions. And a lot of people will come there and they'll say, this meeting makes me really uncomfortable. And someone will say, then what do you mean? Your troubles, your emotional troubles, your uncomfortability is of this meeting's making? And they'll think about it, and then somebody else will say, is it possible? And in my home group, if they say, is it possible, you're screwed. You might as well just crawl right on. They'll say, is it possible that anybody has ever said in this meeting makes you uncomfortable, but the things that are said here bring up things in you that are already there that feel really uncomfortable? Because you could say the same thing to 10 different guys. 9 of them are in a fit spiritual condition, and they don't react, and they don't get uncomfortable. They are at peace, and they have nothing to defend. And the 10th one gets really uncomfortable on the same question that didn't make 9 other people uncomfortable. So there's nothing that Mark and I are going to bring up that's going to make you anything. But I do believe this. I believe he and I have developed techniques working with alcoholics in our living room and doing this kind of thing, where those that stay and are willing to pray, we can bring you to what you're currently up against that you might not even be awake to. No matter what step you're in, I believe that these questions, not that Mark and I can do it, I believe the questions that the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous are going to raise will bring you to whatever you're currently up against in whatever step you're in. Might even show you, like it did me the first time, you're suffering from a part of the disease you don't even know you have in a program you're not even in. We did one of these one time and went to lunch on Saturday morning after we had been in step one all Friday and all Saturday morning. Went to lunch with about 10 women, which I really liked. And about 15 minutes into the lunch, all of them were in tears.
He did that again today at lunch with Melba.
Right? And it wasn't anything I did to her. The other thing I wanted to talk about, this kind of care that you have to be effective with alcoholics. You have to care more about whether they live or die than how their uncomfortability is going to make you feel. Or you can't care whether they're going to like you or not. Don't ever start sponsoring people to make friends. You'll either be their friend or you'll be their sponsor. Our great grand sponsor, Paul Martin in Chicago, always says about a therapist, when you get a therapist, you're buying a good friend. I understand that, having been a therapist, drunk and sober, till it damn near killed me, drunk and sober. And I don't look for people to sponsor that want to be friends. Once in a while, here and there, I have become friends with people I sponsor. Not always. And if I cared about that, I would become ineffective. What they're going to do with it, how they might feel about anything I have to say, because I've been brought to a place where I care whether they live or die, and I've also been brought to a place to know that I can't pull off either one. I can't pull off whether I live or die. How can I pull off whether they live or die? The other thing I wanted to talk about is real hope for an alcoholic and false hope for an alcoholic. Now, you know those people out there? Some of you have gone to church with one of them. Some of you have drank with some of them. Some of you are married to some of them. You know those people. Those people that can have a drink and a half. And across a crowded restaurant 350 feet away from their table, it's not the drink that bothers you that they have. It's the half that they leave. You're sitting there at dinner with somebody you really love, and you cannot get your eye off that fucking half a drink they left at that table over there. You know those people. The people that we don't understand, nor do they understand us. They're the ones that say to us, can't you just outgrow this thing you're going through? Right? My brother used to say that to me. Oh, it's just a phase. He'll outgrow it. Like a 20-year phase, right? Now, those people don't suffer from a basic thing that we suffer from, all of us that need these 12 steps. Those people don't suffer from the basic thing that'll join all of us, alcoholic, Al-Anon, overeaters, whatever it is. After we get past the craving and the obsession, we're going to find out that all of us that suffer from these diseases suffer from something at a real basic level. It's called lack of power. You know, there's people out there in the world self-help works for. You know those people. It seems like the self-help book you read last year worked for them. Because they hear a great message and they go, man, I wish I would have known that a long time ago, because now all I have to do is start doing this. And they start doing it. And you start doing it, and 6 weeks later you're back into absolute fear because you don't have the power to do what they do. We have to do 1 through 9 to just walk into a church where most people just start. Right? I'm at lunch one day in Beverly Hills, and I'm next to these two women, and I hear these two women, two of them, those kind of people. I heard them say to each other, one says to the other, isn't it great that we get together on a regular basis and just clear the air? And I think to myself, I have to go from facing my death in step one to coming to believe that there's a power that can help me do that, making a decision, writing an inventory, fist-stepping it with people I don't even like, asking this God I'm not really sure about to remove that stuff, putting their name on a list to just sit with somebody and say, do you and I need to clear the air? And they just do it. Right? Now, I'd like to present the idea for you to consider that there's a kind of hope that works for them, and there's a kind of hope that works for us. You ever gone to a motivational talk with somebody, either at a therapy office or a church or even an AA meeting? You know, one of those real, you can do it, rah, rah, rah kind of speakers. And you walk out of there with your normal friend, wherever it might be, from that church or that self-help group or that AA meeting. And you walk out of there and your friend is like, man, if I would have just known that, it was so inspirational. Now that I've seen that I do this and I can just do this and now I'll get that and then I'll have this. And they go home and they just do it because they were given a message of hope grounded in something that they could do on their own power without God. And you go home and you're really inspired for about 15-20 minutes, and you go to sleep and you wake up the next morning and you go, I'm going to do like Charlie said he was going to do, and now that I've seen that I do this and I can just do this, and then 6 weeks later you're back into stark raving fear, and you just keep going from hope, false hope, to fear, false hope, to fear, hope, to fear, hope, to fear. It's not the kind of hope that works for an alcoholic. So what's the kind of hope that works for an alcoholic? Hopelessness. No hope. Because as long as there's anything anybody can do in this room, from the newest guy here tonight to the oldest person in the rooms in sobriety, if there's anything you can do to keep yourself sober, why would you need to turn to something more powerful than you? If you're the solution, why would you need anything else? And if there's anything any of us in this room can do to keep ourselves sober, we're probably not alcoholic. And I'm talking about even the stuff in this book. But if you take the first step all the way down as far as you possibly can and see there's nothing you can do to keep yourself sober, you will then turn with the desperation of a drowning man to that which already is. We don't have to realize anything that's not already there. It's amazing to me that alkies like some of us with the lives we've had and the way we drank would even sit around and think, now let me see, am I really powerless over alcohol, right? And then you have this devastated life and you sit around thinking about, now, is my life, you mean they mean, do they really mean like really unmanageable? Like, sort of unmanageable. You mean, they actually mean when you say powerless over alcohol. Now, that doesn't mean like really powerless over alcohol. That means powerless over alcohol, but today I have a choice. No, that means powerless over alcohol. That actually means, now let me get this right. Let me get this right. To admit that you're powerless over alcohol actually means that you're powerless over alcohol. That's like those of us that are educated way beyond our capabilities, right? We hear how it works so many times, we no longer believe, and you have to be like knocked in the head by your sponsor with a 2x4 to go, now let me get this straight. What you're trying to tell me is that how it works actually means how it works. But how many of us in this room have heard how it works read so many times from time to time that we forget that how it works is how it, or you mean that there is a solution actually means that, now let me get this right. I've been to 7 colleges. I have a master's degree in psychology. I've been a therapist in a treatment center. My sponsor says, my God, you know enough about yourself, how you feel, and alcoholism to be dangerous to yourself and everybody around you. And they actually mean that there is a solution. Now, that actually means that there is a solution. That's how simple it is. We'll sit around debating about finding a power greater than ourselves, which has already found us and is already keeping us sober, way before we realize it's even there. Right? Oh, today I found God. Well, how long have you been sober? 6 months. Okay. He found you 6 months ago. It only took you 6 months to realize something that was already going on. Right? Now, let me get this next one straight. We're going to decide to turn our wills and our lives over to the care of that which gave us both in the first place. That's like those arrogant alcoholics that actually think, I can't, he can, I think I'll let him. Now, isn't that a wonderful thing? I think I'll let God, right? If I can let God, I got more power than God, right? Or I'm going to surrender, right? I am going to surrender, right? If I could pull about my own surrender or make my own spiritual growth go the way I would like it, I wouldn't be in Virginia Beach tonight. I would have an ashram with about 5,000 devotees, and you would all be worshiping me because I would be doing a lot better than I am 14 years sober. If I could self-will my spiritual growth. So myth after myth after myth gets smashed. You get brought to the truth. But just before you're brought to the truth, it really pisses you off. You have to go through being pissed off to the other side of, why does it piss? Why am I uncomfortable? Why is this bringing this up? What is this that's coming up? Go through your comfort zone to the other side of the first step. So real care and real hope. Isn't it interesting? There's a paradox. To really care about an alcoholic, you can't care. First spiritual principle we were ever taught. If you don't care, I can't. You ever try to talk to an alcoholic? Do you want to get sober? No, it goes no further. The big book even says, drop him. You might spoil a later chance. You willing to go to any length? Nope. You cannot go any further. Do you want to live? Imagine trying to do a 12-step call on a wet drunk that doesn't care about living. If they don't have a little spark that somewhere in there wants to live, there's nowhere you can go, and then you got to get to, do you want to quit drinking? If that ends with no, you can't go any further. So to care, you can't care. And to have hope, there can't be any. So our hope comes from hopelessness. Our cares come from not caring, but caring in a way that you're taken to when you realize what you can't care about, and hope is what you're brought to when you realize you don't have any. And those that understand that, you're probably listening with the right organ that will work this weekend. And it won't be this organ. That lets all of us off the hook. That lets you, those of you that are too educated to understand off the hook, because you're not going to graduate, you're not going to get any smarter, and that lets those of us off the hook that have lost a little bit up here, because we don't have to get any smarter either. You just have to ask God to open your heart. What about this prayer?
The experience of the experience is more important than the explanation of the experience. The experience of the experience is far more important than the explanation of the experience.
Even in the middle of the understanding that you have about what's even gone on so far, what the actual experience is much more important than any of the understanding that any of us have on what's been said, right underneath what's being said.
Couple things, and I want to talk about this prayer. You know, one is that if Joe and I say anything you cannot reconcile with the big book of the Alcoholics Anonymous, we're wrong. I want to get real clear about that. Second is, don't let anybody read your big book for you. The other thing that will happen for a lot of you this weekend is, if you're like me, you're going to spend a lot of time in Alcoholics Anonymous getting rid of belief systems you developed in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you're also probably going to find it pretty humorous when you begin to look at where in the hell you got those ideas and those belief systems. Things like just don't drink and go to meetings.
You'll never recover. You'll always be recovering.
Put the plug in the jug.
You'll never finish amends.
The list just goes on and on and on. There are many, many, many of these cute, trite little things. Matter of fact, Joe's got a mug that's got them all on it, I think. But you won't find them in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the tragedy about that, for real alcoholic, is that we're dying. I want to talk about a couple things. I shared this last night when I spoke, but there's another reason I won't ever lie to an alcoholic. You know, in the last year, in the last 24 months, 27 people I personally know have died of alcoholism. Two of those were men that I took up to the ninth step. One made amends. Quit doing the work in 10 and 11, wouldn't sponsor anyone. 12 years, picked up a drink. Then his head convinced him he could do a little bit of heroin, and he OD'd. Another man was a counselor, 7 years. Got to amends and wouldn't finish amends. Going to meetings for all the wrong reasons. Picked up a beer. Drank for a couple days, decided he'd do a little methadone. His wife decides she'd do a little with him. She wakes up 2 a.m, he's curled at her feet in the fetal position with blood running out of his mouth, deader than a doorknob. Wonderful men. Wonderful men. I swap fifth steps with these men. Joe and I aren't going to sit up here and lie to you. My experience, I work at a treatment center. I work in the alumni department. I'm not a counselor. Enough of those out there. Death has been taken away from us in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I went around this room and said, when was the last time somebody in your home group died, most of you couldn't even give me an answer. Well, they used to die right in your groups. And working at a treatment center, the death, I'm not removed from the death from alcoholism, like a lot of you have been. You've been removed from people dying of alcoholism. Woman, fifth time in treatment. Never written inventory, in and out AA, 2 years. She had a 3-month-old baby, picked up a drink, 4 days, she died, alcohol poisoning. I see it all the time. I am not removed from the death from this illness. I understand the fatal nature of this illness. I'll give you some statistics. And the tragedy is, the big book says of those who come to AA and really tried, 50% got sober and never relapsed, another 25%, a 75% recovery rate. A friend of mine works at Intergroup in Houston, Texas. They sell chips. We give out chips instead of the glory of God. Ain't that a bitch? It's about the glory of God, and we give out chips, right? 1989, they sold 43,000 Desire chips. In 1990, they sold 3,000 one-year chips. How many of you got 5 years sobriety? Raise your hands. They sold 1,200 five-year chips. Now, they started with 43,000. What do you think happened to those people? This is a fatal illness that kills and kills every time. If you're sitting in this room and your experience confirms you're a real alcoholic, and I don't care how long you've been around, if you do not have a vital spiritual experience and continue to grow in your relationship with God, you, like me, are doomed to die an alcoholic death. I don't know what percent. It's tiny. That ever get sober, stay sober, and die sober. You stay along around this program long enough, you'll get just like Joe and I, where you told to get free of worrying about how you might feel about what I have to say to you. You know, we had an interesting lunch today. Melba was crying. Rod just got uncomfortable as hell. Because, boy, we were asking some questions. Because we love both those people a hell of a lot. And we had to move past Melba's tears. And we had to move past Rod getting uncomfortable a couple times, telling him, I always want to get a pacifier, like for babies. And, you know, I think it's an easy way when someone, the ego, when it must defend, of course, it begins to interrupt and yes, but, and da, 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 da. I just want to pull out and say, here, I wanted to give that to Rod today. Just put it in your mouth.
Rob would answer questions before the question was even done being asked.
Yeah. Doing tag along. But the longer I'm around and the more I have experience with this fatal illness that I have, it really takes me to a place of I won't lie to an alcoholic. I will not lie to an alcoholic. I won't say shit like, keep coming back, it gets better. I'll tell you stay. I'll tell you to seek recovery with the desperation of drowning man or drowning woman if you got this illness. So that has a lot to do with perhaps with the place that Joe and I come from. And of all the people we got sober, as far as I know, there's three of us that are still sober. You know, it's much like the group in Philadelphia or other places. You know, if you sit right now, they've got a group, 10, 15, 20 people. You watch how many of them are around a year from now, 2 years from now, 10 years from now. You watch. See, I'm glad I know what the hell's wrong with me. And one of the reasons is I continually go through these steps and I continually take a look at step one. You know, I got a chance to spend some time with Paul Martin this year. He was the Saturday night speaker in Odessa, Texas at the 51st State Convention in Texas. Paul speaks only twice a year. And I talked to him at length about a lot of long-term sobriety, picking up drinks and dying and all that stuff. And, you know,
great article a couple months ago on the Eighth Tradition.
In the grapevine. You know, here's a man who at 74 years of age is continually working the steps all the time, doing fifth steps all the time. Because he understands it's about your current experience with God. He understands that you cannot defeat your ego. Your ego is mysterious and powerful to you as God himself as far as you're concerned. Your self-will cannot eliminate your self-will. The reason I opened this with a prayer and I ask you to go inside is very simple. As a result of doing that, we are now a spiritual body. And a promise was given us that we're two or more gathered in his name, he'll be there and he'll be here. And that leads me into this other prayer that I want to talk about.
Let's look at some references that the book makes to the ideas about this prayer, because it's sometimes a little deceiving once in a while when you'll meet somebody and they'll ask, well, what is doing this work? What does it mean when you say doing the work? And I'll say, starting on the title page and doing everything in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then the first thing you give them is a prayer that's not really in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, a prayer that was given to me 14 years ago when I told my sponsor some of my experience, and he said, my God, you know enough about yourself and how you feel and alcoholism to be dangerous to yourself and everybody around you. Why don't you just say a prayer that what you think you know be put aside just long enough to have an open mind and a new experience? And I've been using that prayer ever since, whenever I start the work. And this prayer, I don't think is for anybody to use unless you're here this weekend for an experience. And don't use this prayer after this weekend unless you're in the process of the first three steps. This is not like a daily prayer. This is not a prayer to use on a bad day. This isn't a little fix-it prayer. This is a prayer that will take you to the middle of what you need to currently face. And you should say it in your own way. And you should say it in your own words. People that I work with, I encourage people to pray on their knees, but I would never tell anybody, you have to pray on your knees. I don't believe getting on your knees is for God. I believe getting on our knees is for us to appease our own spirit to make some kind of an act. And I believe the words are not important as long as you understand the idea. He'll take us through it. We'll do a little meditation. Let me mention a couple places. The book mentions it. In the chapter, there is a solution. The guy says, the moment I made up my mind to go through with the process, I had to throw several lifelong conceptions out the window. Question. We always take statements in the book and we turn them to questions. Can I, on my own power, throw out several lifelong conceptions? No, how would you do that? I would begin to pray. The chapter, We Agnostic, says, as soon as you're able to lay aside prejudice and express a willingness to believe, commence to get results. It talks about don't let any prejudice you have against spiritual terms keep you from honestly asking yourself what they mean to you. It talks about something that beats you into a state of reasonableness. The only people I've ever see have trouble with the set-aside prayer and the ideas contained in it are those that haven't drank enough whiskey or hit bottom with their own first step. And the ego will kick up and they won't do the prayer and they will not get past the current knowledge they have and they will not have an open mind and they will not have a new experience. I think the appendix, spiritual experience, refers to contempt prior to investigation. Dear God, please put aside what I think I know. Put anything in there you want to have an open mind and a new experience with this weekend. You might put in there my first step. You might put in there these two guys. You might put in there what's supposed to go on this weekend. Please put aside what I think about you, God. Please put aside what I think I know about this book, these steps, this program. Anything you'd like to have an open mind and a new experience with, and the prayer will work. I have never seen the prayer not work. And I've used it 14 times. And I use it from the day I start the work till the day I get to the third step and I have a new prayer. A new third step. I have a new third step. And I'll drop the set-aside prayer and I'll start using the third step prayer. And I've used, just to give you an example, a couple times ago through the work, and I probably should have said earlier, we're not from the school that says you work the first nine steps once. I live my life in 10, 11, and 12, and I go through the first nine steps when my intuitions, when that thing, you want to know the guy that knows about it? Read Harry Thiebaud. He knew more about why, and see, we got a doctor that told us about the body, one that told us about the mind, and one that told us about the spirit. And Dr. Harry Thiebaud knew why an alcoholic needs to submit himself to the first nine steps on a regular basis better than some of us did. Silkworth knew more about the craving than some of us did, and Carl Jung knew about the obsessions of the mind. See, I don't have a twofold disease. And those people that have been going around telling you got a twofold disease, they don't believe in what the big book says. My big book says I am not only bodily and mentally ill, I am spiritually sick, and that I have a spiritual malady, the root of my disease. But we've got to start sometime tonight on the two symptoms, body and mind. But there's a prayer. There's a prayer that will encourage you to do in your own words, in your own way, and put anything you want to have an open mind and a new experience with this weekend into the middle of the prayer. A couple times through the work ago, I did it with four people. We were going to spend a week on the craving, a week on the obsession, a week on the spiritual malady. I started the set-aside prayer. We were looking at the craving for a week. I woke up three mornings in a row with going on in my head without me. You know when you wake up and start to think about something, and then some mornings you wake up with something already going on beyond your control? One of the committee members woke up before you did, right? And he's going full blast, beyond my control, doubt whether I ever had the physical craving, and I knew the prayer was working. You want to know how? I can't tell you how it's going to feel, because for everybody it feels different. So does the first step. But I can tell you some things that will start happening, and if this prayer works for you, you will start to wonder about things you were sure about 10 minutes before you started the prayer. You'll start to wonder. That's the place where you and I can be moved from.
You know, they don't reference it, but for me, in this attitude on page 55 of the Big Book uses the word attitude a lot, and it describes this attitude on page 55, and to me it says more about the set-aside prayer than a lot of these other references, and that is that it says if I'm willing to do three things, one is to lay aside prejudice. For those of you who don't know what that word means, it means preconceived thought or opinion. Prejudice is everything that all of us in this room bring right up to this moment in time as we come in here. So it says, if I'm willing to lay aside prejudice, think honestly and search deep within myself. It says, if I'm willing to do that, it uses the phraseology, it says, I cannot fail. And then it goes on to tell me why. It says, the consciousness of my belief is sure to come to me, this experience with God. I've done some work with some of the tools that Thomas Merton gives, and I love what he says. He talks about going through life wide open. Wide open. Wide open. Lay aside prejudice. But I have enough experience to know I can't do that on my power. So, you know, Joe and I, as we sit here and as we do this prayer this all this weekend, please understand he and I will be having a completely new experience. Because we know that this prayer will work, asking God to lay us aside what we think we know. So what I'd like to do is each of us, I'd like to just take about a minute of it, that each of us go inside ourselves and maybe ask this power to show us what we need to stick in this prayer. And then I would like us all as a group together to say this prayer. Now, I will encourage you to do something else. This program is about real power. It is about God. This is not something to mess with. You know, before you make your third step decision, say that prayer. It says we need to think well before taking this step, making sure we're ready. If you're just here and you're messing with this thing, I do not suggest that you use this prayer. Just like if you get to the third step. If you're not willing to do the rest of the work, don't do the third step. We're talking real power here. This is not some little thing here. We're talking about God. So, let's each of us take about a minute or so and go inside. And then I'd like us all to say this set-aside prayer together. And in that time, in that minute or so, ask God, maybe, to show you what it is you need to stick in terms of this prayer, something that you would like to add in addition to what the words are that we have here. Okay?
So when you take us through the prayer, since we don't all know what's supposed to go in that prayer, why don't you say a line and we'll say a line. And as he's saying the things that he'd like to have an open mind and a new experience with, you think of your own. That you'd like to have an open mind and a new experience with this weekend.
Now we'll begin to say this prayer, so I'll say a few words, and then if you'll just repeat after me. God, please set aside everything I think I know.
God.
About myself. The 12 steps. This book. The meetings. My disease, and you, God, so I may have an open mind
and a new experience
with all of these things. Please let me see the truth.
Please help me see the truth. I'd like to get through these before 9. I would love to spend the whole weekend just talking about the difference between seeking comfort and relief and serenity than real freedom and peace and power. Too many of us, me included, we settle for comfort We're going to find when we get to the ninth step, the number of people in this room, just like me, that are three-fourths of their way through their first set of amends, and they've settled for the comfort that those first 9.5 steps have taken them to, because they don't think those unfinished amends have anything to do with drinking alcohol, and they've lost their first step, and they've settled for comfort. We've seen a lot of people in AA die from comfort. It's an illusion. It's an illusionary power. That does not mean doing this work won't take you to a place where you're at peace. But I'll tell you what real peace is. Real peace is when you are at peace and uncomfortable emotionally or physically or mentally at the same time. Because I have an ego that says you cannot be in pain and at peace in the same body. So I have to do everything I can to avoid pain, and it perpetuates more pain. Real freedom is those times where you're emotionally in turmoil. When do you really need God? Isn't it interesting? The ego would convince you when you don't really need God is when you don't really need God. I need God when I'm in pain. And He's there. You can be at peace and in pain. Your mind can be going 1,000,000 miles an hour and you can find peace in another place that's beyond mind. Beyond mind. The book talks about the realm of the spirit, fourth dimension, deep, great reality, whatever you want to call it. There is a place within each and every one of us beyond comfort. But you got to go for it. You got to seek it. You got to want more than the current comfortable place that you might be. Who's in better shape? The guy that knows he's dying of an incurable disease that no human power can relieve and he's really uncomfortable, or the guy that thinks everything's just dandy and those unfinished amends don't have anything to do with booze this many years sober because he has settled for comfort? The guy in pain is in better shape. You know that perplexing chapter that probably some of you wouldn't understand, that don't understand us? That chapter that talks about alcoholic number one, number two, number three, number four. And alcoholic number four is in bad shape. And you know what they say about alcoholic number four? His chances are better than alcoholic number one, who's got it going on and hasn't lost that much. Now, that's an interesting thing to look at for a while. Now, what about questions and answers? I was asked a question several years ago, and the question I was asked was, what's the most important thing when asked the question? How many in the room, by a show of hands, because we're going to go through a series of questions here, and you're going to have to be honest enough to raise your hand with what you currently believe to get past where you are. You can't get past where you are if you do not admit where you are. That's what the first step is going to do for each and every one of us. The first step is going to locate us, because you cannot get from Santa Monica to Virginia Beach if you're in Malibu. You'll keep trying to get from Santa Monica to Virginia Beach, and you won't, because you can't admit where you are. How many in the room, just like me, believe the most important thing when asked a question is the answer? How many believe that? Well, it's not. The most important thing when asked a question is when you're in the middle and you're wondering about it. Because if you're asked a question and your ego goes right to the answer, you've shut off any experience the question could create if you were to just sit with the question for a while. And when I was asked, what's the most important thing when asked a question, I said the answer. And this man said, not these questions. The most important thing when asked these questions in the first three steps, because that's all you're going to find the first three steps are, a series of considerations, if done in order, are meant to bring you to a place where you can fully concede to your innermost self that you're alcoholic, that your life is unmanageable, that no human power can relieve your alcoholism, and you be willing to believe that God not only can, but that He will for you if you seek Him. That's all the first three steps are designed to do. See you where your life run on your will has gotten you, and help you make a decision about the rest of your life and your will. But let's not make any big decisions in the first year, right? Then the next week they're asking you to decide to turn your entire will and life over to the care of God, right? Don't have a relationship don't get involved with anybody in the first year, right? Well, where I come from, they don't know if that works because nobody's ever done it, right? We can go into the next thing before the break. And so quit looking for answers. The answers aren't in the answer. The answers are in the question, and the answers are deep down within you, not up here in your mind when your mind wants to answer the question right away. Am I alcoholic? Sure I am. You've just shut off the experience. What did you look at? Well, maybe I'm not. And I'll tell you, those of us that have been around for a while will get a lot more benefit from looking at maybe we're not to find out we really are than how much we really believe we really are, because we're only going to go back to old information. You cannot start this process with an answer. If you start this process with an answer, you will not end up with anything you didn't already have. You'll end up with the same answer you had when you started. You must start this process with a question. Why am I powerless over alcohol? Bodily. And then we'll look at why are we powerless over alcohol mentally. And then we'll look at why is my life unmanageable spiritually. But there's some questions before the questions. And there's some questions that will give us a feel for the room. And there are a set of questions that we came up with on a plane ride one time. And we were wondering, do you think there's a set of questions we could ask at the beginning of one of these weekends? And then ask them again before we take the third step as a group that would show movement in the room as far as change in thinking. And these questions flew out of our consciousness. And they're every myth we've ever come up against, mainly in the first three steps. I mean, we could probably write a book on just the myths that we've discovered within ourselves. Mark and I have never discovered any myths in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have only discovered myths within ourselves that we see reflected out here that are really a reflection of our own myths. And these are some of the myths we found within ourselves over the years in the first three steps. And we can see where we are as a group. And I'll read what we wrote here at the top, and then he'll take us through some of these questions. At the top of the page, it says, questions concerning current beliefs in Alcoholics Anonymous. Next paragraph says, these questions are designed to explore some current myths in Alcoholics Anonymous. It should probably say within yourself. Answer them at the beginning of the work, before the doctor's opinion, and again before doing the third step prayer to see change in your thinking and belief system. Question number one, by a show of hands.
Let me say one thing before, because I smell something going on in the room. What I smell is when Joe asked that question about what's the most important thing with pose, with a question, a very few of you raised your hands, and I just know from experience, if your ego hadn't got involved, there would have been a hell of a lot more hands. You will never find truth trying to worry about whether it's right or wrong. None of this is about right or wrong. This is about us showing up here. It's 8:52. I want a new experience. So when posed with the questions, just answer them. Answer them quick. This is not about looking around saying, oh, geez, I wonder whether I'm going to be right or wrong. You got to drop that shit. It isn't about right or wrong, good or bad. It isn't about any of that. That's just more stuff the ego's manufactured.
The morality of AA is not right and wrong. You know what the morality of AA is? Does it work? Does your current belief system work? And here's one for those of you that have been around for a while and you start the work the next time. Here's one to consider. Can you use the current belief system that has brought you to where you are with the current unmanageability and the spiritual malady in your life to get yourself out of it? You cannot use the mind and the belief system that has brought you to where you are to get you out of where you are. So I'm going to start with a question that's not on here. I don't know if he's heard this one yet, but I did this with a group not too long ago, and it was amazing because it's one of the biggest myths that I've ever had. And you got to be honest. So with a show of hands, and this one you have to go with the first thing that comes to your mind. If you think about it, like our friend over here would, right, you'll miss the experience. And you just have to go with what's on the top of your consciousness. How many in this room, when asked, your number one priority would say your sobriety? Okay. Keep your hands up. Keep your hands up just for a minute. Check this out. Isn't it interesting that your ego has convinced you your number one priority is probably the only thing you can't do anything about? And if you were to see that, your number one priority would change. Because if you were to see there's nothing you can do about your sobriety with the desperation of a drowning man, you would seek with the desperation of a drowning man, your number one priority would be to get closer to that which is already given you, which you think is your number one priority.
I gave you this answer when I read Our Working With Others. Do you have a desire to find God, or does it come from within you? It didn't say anything about getting sober.
My number one priority is not sobriety. I can't do anything about staying sober. I cannot keep myself sober. And based on that admission, you know what comes to me? My number one priority is to seek that which already is.
So let's look at these. Again, do the same thing. Answer it based on the belief system you brought here. Don't worry about who sees you raising your hand.
And watch the change that might take place for a lot of us between now and the time we take the third step, probably tomorrow before lunch.
Do you believe you work steps 1 through 9 once and maintain 10, 11, and 12? How many believe that?
1 through 9 once.
Work them once, maintain 10, 11, and 12.
Okay.
Okay. How many of you believe you do 1 through 9 on a regular basis using 10, 11, and 12? Okay. How many people believe studying the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous will produce a spiritual experience? How many people believe what's doing in the big book will produce the spiritual experience?
How many believe with the first three steps we should look in the book for the right answers? Go with the beliefs you brought here tonight.
Yeah, go answer the questions based on that.
How many believe with the first three steps we should look in the big book for the right questions? Okay. Some of you have been educated way beyond your capabilities and current power. That's why you had to stop reading. There's nothing worse in your first set of amends than reading spiritual books that'll take your mind past the current power you have from not finishing amends and end amends with more awareness than you do power to do anything with what you read about. And if you understand that, you're using the right organ to listen with tonight.
How many people believe alcoholism and drug addiction are the same? Raise your hands.
Drug addiction and alcoholism are the same.
Okay, we had about 10, 15 of you.
How many believe you can recover from alcoholism or you'll always be recovering? How many believe you'll always be recovering? Sad, isn't it? You don't even have the modesty of our founders. You got a false modesty that our founders didn't even have. Keep in mind, here's another myth. Nobody that wrote this book had more than 5 years when they claimed to be recovered. Nobody had more than 5 years when this book came out. Bill Wilson got sober when? 1935. The book came out?
39.
Nobody had more than 5 years. What did they claim? Why can't we? Why aren't we? Because every one of you that raised your hands that's not recovered isn't, and you have unfinished amends which need to be finished to be taken to a recovered state.
Not only that, but if you have a sponsor that doesn't believe they're recovering, you're not following the instructions in the big book. The big book says in working with others, I need to find someone who's recovered.
Doesn't the first paragraph of the first foreword of the first edition say, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book? If you don't have a sponsor that believes that, you better get a new one.
Get a Concordia. The word recovered is used 15 times. The word recovering is used 4, and it's the last 4 chapters which discuss how to practice these principles in all your affairs. The other thing is start asking yourself where the hell your belief systems are coming from.
He gave me that question a long time ago, and I found some amazing places my belief systems were coming from. Mostly myself.
Yeah. Joe and I's program would kill you, but this program works great. How many people believe the main purpose of the big book is to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered?
How many believe the big book has another main purpose? Ah, those are the smart ones, educated way beyond their capabilities, because they know that a little later it says, also, the main purpose is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will take you to a recovered state. So they're both saying the same thing. How many believe if the obsession to drink occurred, that thinking it through to where it would take them, or remembering the pain of their last drunk, could stop them from drinking by thinking it through? Good. Our friend in Indianapolis, my grand sponsor, Gary, says, if the pain of your last drunk would work for an alcoholic, then the pain of your last childbirth would make for a great birth control method. Here's one all over the country. Here's one of the biggest ones. And I don't care how long you're sober. How many of you believe today that you have a choice whether you drink or not? Okay? Let me tell you something. That is the insanity of alcoholism.
Did you
Every description that we're going to go through when we look at the mental obsession between page 23 and 43 that describes alcoholic insanity, every one of those ideas is going to be about the guy that thought they had a choice. Now, let me throw this in there, too. Those of you that think God has brought you to a place where today you have a choice, well, let's see those hands. How many believe, let's try two questions. How many believe when they got here and they are powerless over alcohol, they had no choice whether they were going to stay sober or not? They'd lost the power of choice when you got here. No, to the program. To the program. That's a good question. How many believe when you got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you couldn't choose not to drink? You had to drink. Okay. How many believe since then God has given you the power of choice? Well, some of you do. You raised your hands. You said you...
Yeah, a little higher, a little higher. You don't deserve to be doing this. This is great.
Right? Let me ask you this. Those of you that believe God has given you the power of choice over alcohol, what kind of God did you choose that would give you a choice over something you know would kill you? And if you want to take it one step further, if you explore the ideas of will and choice are the same thing. How can those of you that raised your hand say you've given your will to God if you still have a choice? If you've given your will to God in steps 4 through 9, you've given him your choice over alcohol. And one more thing to throw in there, in a fit spiritual condition, in the sunlight of the Spirit, in the place the 10th step describes and the 10th step promises, you have about as much choice to drink as you did to not drink when you got here. And any alcoholic in this room that thinks they have a choice, you are in the middle of the insanity of alcoholism. Here's one we find all over the country that's not on here. How many of you believe there's 12 promises in AA? Only 12 promises. Page 83, halfway through the 9th step. Oh, good. That's not one that's permeated this area. There are promises in this program from every step all the way through.
Back to the issue of choice, the big book in two different places says, I couldn't drink if I would, and I wouldn't drink if I could. How's their choice in the middle of that? You can't believe a little of this big book and not all of it. Half measures availed us nothing. This is not about taking little pieces and saying, well, I believe that, but I don't believe this.
Well, I did when I was new. I related to everything in that book where they described the problem, and as soon as they got to the solution, I said... I heard one the other day, a guy, he took one of Bill's more profound statements, I forgot which one it was, and he said, you know, that's just where Bill was getting a little poetic. But it was a promise that I've experienced myself, personally.
How many people believe alcoholism is a twofold disease?
Body and mind.
Raise them up.
How many believe alcoholism is a threefold disease? Body, mind, and spirit.
How many people think the fellowship of alcoholics?
And if you understand that, you're using the right organ to listen with tonight.
How many people believe alcoholism and drug addiction are the same? Raise your hands.
Drug addiction and alcoholism are the same.
Okay, we had about 10, 15 of you.
How many believe you can recover from alcoholism or you'll always be recovering? How many believe you'll always be recovering? Sad, isn't it? You don't even have the modesty of our founders. You got a false modesty that our founders didn't even have. Keep in mind, here's another myth. Nobody that wrote this book had more than 5 years when they claimed to be recovered. Nobody had more than 5 years when this book came out. Bill Wilson got sober when? 1935. The book came out.
39.
Nobody had more than 5 years. What did they claim? Why can't we? Why aren't we? Because every one of you that raised your hands that's not recovered isn't, and you have unfinished amends which need to be finished to be taken to a recovered state.
Not only that, but if you have a sponsor that doesn't believe they're recovering, you're not following the instructions in the big book. The big book says in working with others, I need to find someone who's recovered.
Doesn't the first paragraph of the first foreword of the first edition say, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book? If you don't have a sponsor that believes that, you better get a new one.
Get a Concordia. The word recovery is used 15 times. The word recovery is used 4, and it's the last 4 chapters which discuss how to practice these principles in all your affairs. The other thing is start asking yourself where the hell your belief systems are